Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, you'll meet Wade Shute and Wayne Wasilsu, two scientists at the Alberta Research Council. The end products they're looking at are paper and panel boards. What's different is the raw material they're working with, namely straw, flax, and hemp. And today's oil sands boom owes its existence to the work of Dr. Carl Clark. His daughter and biographer, Mary Clark Shepherd, takes us back to the 1920s, when her father built a series of pilot plants to try and unlock the mystery of separating oil from the oil sands. That's all coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. With most of the forest resources allocated in Alberta, there's growing interest in the use of alternate fibers to replace wood. These include straw, flax, and hemp. And just so you know, there's nothing euphoric about this kind of hemp, unless, of course, you're a scientist involved in agroforestry research. Recently, I had an opportunity to visit the Alberta Research Council and meet with two of those researchers, Wade Shute and Wayne Wasilsu. Wayne is the technical manager of the Forest Products Testing Lab, and Wade is the senior research engineer for agrifiber pulp and paper. As Wade Shute explains, despite recent prohibitions, hemp actually has a long history in papermaking.
Back in 105 AD, they actually said that the first paper was made with hemp. So it's been used for an awful long time, and it's only since about 1850 that rag pulp, which made from hemp and flax, has been changed over in favor of using wood pulp instead. So, and that all came about as a result of a rag shortage.
What's the difference in the fibers then? Are they very similar, or are there big differences between them?
Well, hemp fibers and flax fibers, the outer part of the plant, it's called the bast fiber. And these bast fibers actually are incredibly long and incredibly strong compared to wood pulp.
So what would you have to do, anything different, in order to turn them into something that could be made into pulp?
Well, a lot of people are claiming that that their own processes work best for processing hemp and flax. Because I come from the mechanical pulping industry, I'm trying to take more of a mainstream approach and use existing equipment and show existing mills how to use their own equipment in order to incorporate this into their own product.
So when you say incorporate, you could have a mixture of hemp or flax fibers in with spruce fibers or aspen. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. As a matter of fact, I'm not really an advocate of switching over 100% to agricultural fibers, because there is more technical merit in blending the properties of wood fibers and agricultural fibers to make a better product. As a matter of fact, even existing papers like your copy paper is a blend of softwood and hardwood fibers. As a result, they actually have properties that are better than hardwoods and softwoods alone.
What would be the advantage or the benefit of switching over or using some of these other fibers?
Well, in many cases, the fiber is stronger, such that if a mixed office waste paper that contains a high recycled content, it tends to be a lot weaker and a lot less stiff. But if you incorporate some hemp and flax into that mix, you produce a stiffer sheet, you produce better printing surfaces, and in many cases you can offset the decrease in quality as a result of the recycled content.
Now, would the hemp and the flax, would that come from Alberta, or would it have to be imported from elsewhere?
Right now, the bulk of the flax that is grown in the world is actually in Saskatchewan and Manitoba. There is some flax acreage that is grown in southern Alberta, typically less than about 70,000 acres a year. Hemp is a relative newcomer, and across Canada, its acreages have ranged anywhere from about 5,000 to about 30,000 tons. I think this year there's somewhere just shy of 20,000 tons of flax fiber, of hemp fiber that's grown.
So, do you see this taking off? Like, where are you in your research?
Well, right now we actually do have some contract research being done by the a few of the mechanical pulp mills in Alberta and Saskatchewan that are looking at this as an alternative fiber source, both for its technical merits as well as for the fact that it's reasonably readily available, and they are running out of allocated forests for future growth. So we are doing a lot of contract research. One study that we've recently done has shown the superiority of blending hemp with softwood to make a newspaper type of pulp. And it seems that relatively small substitutions can go a long ways in terms of manufacturing a superior grade of paper.
Now, those are the good parts. When you get down to the nitty-gritty, so what are some of the hiccups that you've had to deal with?
Well, a lot of the front-end of equipment has still not been developed to successfully use hemp or flax type fibers in the pulp and paper industry. Most of the raw materials have been the raw material feed systems have been designed around wood chips or whole logs. So there is a little bit of a lag there in terms of getting the right technology in order to feed this material into existing pulping processes. Beyond that, the equipment that the pulp mills currently have is plenty sufficient to do the job. So the biggest challenge that we've had so far is basically getting the raw materials into our own processes. Once they're in there, we can do a pretty good job with them.
Okay. Wayne, what is your interest and involvement in the use of agrifibers?
Well, we've been using ag fibers now for about 5 or 6 years in the manufacture of panels, anything ranging from cupboards and cabinetry all the way up to building materials to actually build houses out of it. There are a few commercial projects right now that make panels for use in cabinetry and those types of applications, and we're just starting to get some interest in people using ag fibers for making building materials. So right now we have one product where we can make it out of straw, and it's we're in the middle of commercializing that right now with a few interested parties. And so far it can replace wood in terms of building houses out of. And we are in the process of patenting a method for making panels out of hemp for the same process.
When you say panels, what would you actually do?
Well, we would take the fiber. One thing that we want to do when we make a panel, it's depending on what type of application we're looking at, we change the geometry of the fiber. So if we want to make a panel for cabinets and furniture, what we do is we grind it to a very fine powder almost, glue it together, press it, and then it's good for using for cabinets. If we want to make building materials, we want to keep the fiber as long as possible. We want to be able to carry a lot of weight on the fiber. So what we do is we make it very long, and then we glue it together in a long state, and that allows us to put things like TVs and couches and house, you know, putting a house together sort of thing. So depending on what we're doing, there's different methods for preparing the fiber for different applications. So for hemp, we've found a way where we peel the fiber away, the outer bark, and then we use the inside hird to make panels out of for building materials.
What's the hemp plant like? What are its characteristics?
Well, the plant, depending how you seed it, it can grow very thin and tall or thick and tall, depending on how you seed it. It can be as the diameter of it can be as wide as your pinky finger if you seed it very closely together. If you seed it far apart, if you're making in terms of depending what kind of crop you're looking for, if you're looking for a fiber crop, you want to seed it very close together so the fibers are very fine and very long. If you want to make a seed crop, getting grain for things like oils for cosmetics and those sorts of things, you'd seed it far apart. In that case, the stalks can be up to 2 inches in diameter, if not more, depending on how you manage the crop from an agricultural point of view.
Now, when you say tall, how tall do you mean?
Between 3 and 5 meters, depending on where you are growing it in the province. I've seen crops without rain go as low as 1.5 meters, but in very temperate growing regions with lots of rain, it can get up to 3 to 5 meters tall.
Do we really have a suitable climate and soil conditions here for growing hemp and flax?
You would think not, but we really do. Hemp's been grown in Canada, actually, for quite a few years. About 60, 70 years ago, we grew hemp for the war effort in World War II. At that time, the Canadian government sponsored a lot of hemp growing in Canada, throughout Canada, not just in Western Canada. The crop suited quite well for this area. If it gets rain, it'll grow. If it doesn't get rain, it doesn't grow.
Now, Wade, you have something to add to this.
Well, just perhaps expanding on Wayne's comments here, all depending on the variety of hemp that is grown, there are some that are better for seed, and then there are some that are better for fiber. In some cases, I've seen hemp plants that grow, you know, even less than a meter tall, grand total. These are the ones that are usually the higher seed-bearing varieties. There are some, like Wayne says, like, is it Compulte that is can get up to about 12 to 15 feet and can be often as thick as your wrist, which is a pretty nice fiber to deal with in terms of processing from both Wayne's standpoint and probably from mine as well. It can process for me a lot more like wood chips can. And that makes it, of course, if you get your yield up on a given acre of farm, the economics get a lot better as a raw material for the pulp and paper industry and for the board industry as well.
Wayne, how did you get interested in all this?
Hemp was just a logical progression for where we were with ag fibers in terms of straw. Straw, when we first started working with it, generally gives us a yield of 1 to 2 tons per hectare. That's roughly the average in the prairie. Some places it's higher, some places it's lower, depending on your management practices, rain, soil conditions, all that sort of stuff. But we found that it's one thing you have a problem with ag residues in this type of business is transportation is a huge, huge cost for you. So what you want to do is try to grow as much of material as you can as close as possible to the plant. And that way you reduce a lot of your transportation costs and make it more economical to produce. So when we looked at hemp, we found that hemp can produce without even increasing management practices very, very much. You can get 3 to 5 times the amount of biomass per unit area. So hemp is sort of a logical progression for us. So when we looked at it initially, we said, well, if companies could use this material, then it would mean a better bottom line for them to make panels out of and pulp and paper and those sorts of things. So that's where it came from initially.
Well, certainly you've expressed from a research point of view what the interest is, but is there actually interest on the part of foresters or farmers to get involved in this and incorporate it?
Well, in terms of foresters, I think it's a little bit from my perspective, the chicken and egg thing. Right now, they're interested in it, but they want to see large, large volumes of it grown before they'll be really interested in it. In terms of the farmers, right now, they're looking at it and they're trying to figure out ways of handling this material. It is a totally different crop than they're used to handling in a mechanized fashion. Right now, traditionally, the crop is harvested in Eastern Europe and in China with hand labor. There's no large-scale mechanization there. So I think it's going to take a few farmers and some of their ingenuity to get together and come up with ways of working with it. But I do know, even though they've spent a lot of time and a lot of money with busted combines and busted swathers and those sorts of things, that they are still interested in working with the crop, those people that are involved with it. It sure has captured the imagination of the farmers that have been growing it. That's for sure. That's what I've seen. So I would say from that point of view, it will gain popularity if we find ways of handling it and finding markets for the material, because right now we don't have the markets for it because it's so new. And it's going to take a little bit of time, I think, for the markets to develop. And that way the egg and the chicken will catch up to each other and they'll roll along just fine.
Well, Wade, what have you seen from your end?
Well, I think Wayne's analogy of the chicken and egg is very apt here because farmers are a little bit reluctant as well, given events that have happened elsewhere in Canada, where they were producing this fiber on spec, and it wound up that their markets were just not there at the end of the day. So everybody's a little bit of hand shy from that. So if we can demonstrate that there's a relatively large market for this fiber, farmers will, I think, be a lot more willing to produce it in a larger scale. The thing, like Wayne was saying, is everybody's sort of sitting back and waiting for somebody else to do something first. If we our results so far have been very successful, and if we wind up showing the industry that this stuff has a commercial and a technical advantage over other products of its type, they're going to want to use a lot, and they're going to want to use it now, and then it's going to be a matter of can the fiber supply catch up in time. And there's logistical issues that have to be handled as well, like who's going to harvest this stuff in volume, where is it going to be stored, how is it going to be delivered to the mill, what sort of raw material standards are going to exist for this raw material. So there's a lot of issues that have to be fleshed out, but it's going to have to be fleshed out as soon as the industry starts taking off.
At the trade fair, you were showing me some of these panels that had been made out of straw and hemp, and they looked just like chipboard in a way. Make some comparisons for me. You say it's superior, but what is the difference between a panel that's made from a hemp fiber or straw fiber compared to the wood fibers, the chipboard-oriented strand board, that sort of thing?
Well, different panels have different applications. However, I think probably the main difference is, from a technical standpoint, is the low bulk density or the low parent density straw has. So that means that we can make panels lighter and lighter with the same strength properties. And with wood, with especially aspen that we use here in the province, you can only get down to a certain density, and anything below that density, the panel doesn't hold together very well. It doesn't have very good strength properties. Well, with ag residues, we can make the panels even lighter and still maintain strength, and that's what everybody wants to do. Nobody wants to be carrying around a 200-pound 4x8 sheet, so the lighter we can make it, the easier it is for construction, the easier it is for your do-it-yourselfers at home, those sorts of things. So they're looking for lighter, stronger products. So ag residues allow us to get into that realm, and while straw gives us that much advantage over wood, hemp even gives us more of an advantage over straw. We can make panels very, very light. With hemp, we can use the normal resins that are used in the industry. That's one thing. With straw, we're kind of limited in the types of resins we can use to bind the material together to make a panel. And with hemp, we can use all the resins that are a little bit less expensive and just as effective. And that gives hemp an even a bigger advantage over straw.
How about the environmental benefit?
One thing that straw, I would say, has a greater advantage over wood is in terms of what we can do to straw, in terms of making it better to suit our needs. We're not talking GMOs here, that sort of thing, but we can breed characteristics using natural selection to get better straws, taller straws, shorter straws, stronger straws, weaker straws, whatever we want to do to give us better properties. Right now, we're not looking at straw from that point of view. We've been looking at it as, well, we're just taking it as a waste product. Well, I think in the future we're going to see if this market does take off and does gain acceptance, and we're going to be seeing people saying, well, let's breed straw to make a better material for use in other aspects of application and commercial ventures. And that's where I think there's going to be a huge, huge gain. With wood, we have to wait a long time to reap those benefits, and with straw, we don't. We can have a turnaround within 3, 4, 5 years, and everybody can be growing that material very quickly. Whereas with wood, we have a long time to wait before you can use that and reap those benefits. So that's going to be one advantage I think straw would have over wood.
Even short rotation poplar, as Wayne was mentioning here, has 25 years as opposed to the 60 to 80 years that the stuff is normally grown in. So this annual fiber, be it hemp, flax, or wheat straw, offers a significant advantage. One other thing that we've been finding as well is that all depending on when the crop is harvested in a given year will dictate the fiber properties that you're going to get. For example, if you were to cut hemp halfway through a season and then try pulping it, the fibers themselves are much more slender and make a much denser sheet of paper. Now, this has to be weighed against the economics, but it offers another variable that farmers and even pulp producers can play with. If they want a specific grade of paper, they can let it grow to maturity and harvest it for grain. If they want a different grade of paper, they can harvest it when it's three-quarters grown or whatever. And all of this can happen within a year.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you very much.
That was Wayne Wasilsu, Technical Manager of the Forest Products Testing Lab at the Alberta Research Council. I also spoke with Wade Shute, Senior Research Engineer for Agrifiber Pulp and Paper at the ARC. There's lots happening on the Innovation and Science beat over the next few days. On February 20th and 21st, you can head into Fairview and learn about medicinal herbs. On Track with Medicinals is a two-day workshop about producing and marketing medicinal herbs. The workshop will look at short-term fads and long-term trends, as well as the agronomic principles behind medicinal production. For more information, you can contact Elaine Stratbratton at 780-836-3351. And finally, through February until the end of March, you can take in the exhibit Who Wears the Pants? Gender Roles and Clothing Communication. This exhibit explores how clothing through the 20th century reflects the changing gender roles in Canadian society. That's in the Human Ecology Building at the U of A. If you wish to promote an upcoming seminar or exhibit, please contact me at CKUA Radio. My email address is CherylCroucher@CKUA.org. The 1920s marked an exciting time in oil sands research. As president of the University of Alberta, Henry Marshall Torrey couldn't believe his good luck when he met Carl Clark in Ottawa in 1920. Mucking about in his lab at the mines branch, Clark had come across a way to separate oil from the oil sands. Torrey encouraged the young scientist to come to Edmonton and begin a research program that might lead to a commercialization of the oil sands. Mary Clark Shepherd wrote about this early research in a book about her father called Oil Sands Scientist. She recalls how he began his work in 1921 in the North Lab on the university campus.
He was told by Dr. Torrey to start right from the beginning. He said, I want you to start right from the beginning, analyze this oil, say what it is, and then you can start working on means of separation. And because, of course, they were thinking in terms of oil for roads. He reported to Dr. Torrey, and he also seemed to have was in touch with the premier's office, too. I mean, it was pretty high-powered stuff, as it were. But then the university was very small then, and the city was small. So I guess it wasn't so extraordinary. Yes, he got working straight ahead, and then in 1923, he and Sid Blair built this first plant in the basement of the power plant. And then in 1925, they built one outside at the Dunvegan railway yard. And then in 1929, there was a joint effort with the federal government on the Clearwater River. Then in 1939, he built one at Trail, and the CM&S were interested in that, but the war intervened, and that just, it went nowhere. It didn't go very far, although it did turn up some information. And then in 1949, Bitumount was built. So that was the sequence of work. And then after every plant, then they got oil, and then there were twofold works. One was how to improve the mechanics of the plant and the chemistry of it.
What was it like down in the power plant basement?
It was chosen to go there because it had power and water, because that was where the power plant was. But it had a low ceiling. And so when they designed it, they had to have they shoveled all the tar sands in through a window into a box. And then from that box, the tar sands were taken up to the sort of head of the plant, as it was, by an incline, what my father always called was written in the books as described as an inclined screw. So this thing, you know, screwed the tar sands up to another place. And then the rest of the plant was fed by gravity. So when they went to Dunvegan, which was just north of this, well, it's in the center of the city now, but it was north then. They said, hurrah, hurrah, we don't have to have this wretched inclining screw and this cumbersome affair of raising the tar sands up to the head of the plant.
And they could stand up straight.
And they could stand up straight, yeah. I suppose that's right. And it didn't work. It was a disaster. That plant, the first year. They ran it for two summers. The first year, that it just didn't work. So they shut it down. Well, fortunately, as I remember, the weather went bad, so they could shut it down quickly, they saved a bit of face there. So they went right back to the drawing board to figure it was right back to the beginning again and studying what in the world had gone wrong. And what it turned out was that inclined screw, unknowns to them, was doing a mixing job that was vital. So when they redesigned it and rebuilt it the next summer, and that was B26, and it was run successfully then. They rebuilt it, and they learned from that failure what was wrong. And the interesting thing is, just carrying on, is that they had another big failure. It wasn't a big failure, but it was a significant failure at Clearwater. Because, again, it didn't work. They had dismantled the plant at Dunvegan and carried it up bit by bit by bit to Clearwater and reassembled it on the Clearwater River across from waterways. But it didn't work. And then my father watched and watched and watched, and then he began to realize that there was a lot of salt around. So what had happened in Clearwater, they worked out, was that there was a lot of salt had seeped into the groundwaters And this was affecting the pH, the acidity of the tar sands, and it had to be, they had to get the acidity just right. It had to be slightly more alkaline than acidic. And so after all sorts of work in the laboratory, he worked out the formula. I think when they were up at Clearwater, they actually did do some, they did some adjustments while they were there. But that wasn't good enough. He had to know why it worked. And that, of course, that was the great thing about my father, and I suppose all scientists. It's not only enough to see that it works, you have to know why it works. So after Clearwater, then there was a lot more, because they analyzed everything, and they did runs after runs after runs, and I've seen his notebooks, and just all lined in, all the itemized columns of figures, and day run after run after run after run, you know, hundreds of runs, all meticulously recorded and analyzed. And they worked out that this pH balance was very important if you were going to get a good separation.
So after they made this important discovery, what happened then?
Well, you see, the 1929-30 Clearwater plant, that ended in 1930, and it was reported all over the, I mean, all the major scientific journals reported it. It was noted in England, it was noted in New York or wherever in the American scientific journals. But then, in, don't forget, the crash came in 29. And it was being felt by 31, and they didn't get any money. And by 1932, the Research Council was shut down because the government had no more money. But my father had enough material from the Clearwater plant to work on, and he worked on it for 2 years trying to elucidate how to deal with this. So that was 12 years from the time he began. And then the Research Council shut down. So there was no more official work done. He had no lab to work in, no lab assistant, no equipment he could buy or anything. He had nothing, actually, because I think they did. They just shut the lab down.
That was Mary Clark Shepherd, daughter of Dr. Carl Clark. Her book, Oil Sand Scientist, is available from the University of Alberta Press. Next week, Mary talks about the period after World War II, when the Research Council is revitalized and her father finally perfects the technology to commercialize the oil sands. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. I welcome your comments and suggestions. Send your emails to CherylCroucher@ckua.org and check out our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. The guitar music tonight was from a recording by Preston Reed, his CD entitled The Road Less Traveled. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.